On this edition for Sunday, May 17th, more stay-at-home orders are lifted and businesses start to reopen. Concerns over COVID-19 as pipeline construction continues, and children's literary titles reimagined for pandemic times. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the JPB Foundation, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. The measures put in place to slow the spread of the coronavirus are being lifted as spring weather arrives in much of the country and Memorial Day weekend approaches. The number of new cases is dropping or on a plateau in all but a few states. So let's get started with today's top stories. Reopening the country is now proceeding both slowly and quickly, all depending on where you live. Parks are open in New York City with social distancing limits. Casinos in Arizona are open.
It was busy. In fact, it's packed in there.
In other places, businesses like these California restaurants defied shutdown orders and reopened. Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar said he does not think there should be a one-size-fits-all approach to reopening, but cautioned those in regions with high rates of COVID-19 infections.
I think in any individual instance, you're going to see people doing things that are irresponsible. That's part of the freedom that we have here in America. We can give guidance, as the Surgeon General did.
More states plan to lift stay-at-home orders and allow additional businesses to open in the coming week. In Europe, after more than 2 months under one of the strictest lockdowns, Italy is set to ease many restrictions this week. Tomorrow, bars, restaurants, and non-essential shops will reopen, and residents will no longer have to justify local travel. While large gatherings are still banned, religious ceremonies can be held and galleries and museums can open. In India, officials extended parts of its lockdown for 2 more weeks. It had been set to expire tonight at midnight. There are more than 90,000 confirmed coronavirus cases in India, one of the highest totals in Asia. And in Wuhan, China, where the new coronavirus first emerged, health officials have started a citywide testing campaign to look for asymptomatic carriers of the virus. Officials announced that they tested more than 220,000 people on Saturday, all volunteers, nearly doubling the number of people tested the day before. Also in international news, today Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and rival Abdullah Abdullah signed a power-sharing agreement. Both held inauguration ceremonies in March after claiming victory in last September's presidential election. The agreement allows Ghani to retain office as president while making Abdullah head of the High Council that will oversee the government's role in the stalled peace process. An agreement signed in February between the United States and the Taliban calls for the removal of U.S. and NATO troops from Afghanistan. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new unity government was sworn in today after 3 deadlocked elections. In an unusual agreement, Netanyahu will serve as prime minister for the first 18 months, and his rival Benny Gantz will serve the next 18 months. Speaking to Parliament, Netanyahu said that compromises will be made, but the benefits far outweigh holding more elections. The swearing-in comes 1 week before Netanyahu goes on trial to face corruption charges. In the United States, May is graduation month for many students, but this year, without much of the pomp and ceremony, many commencements are taking place virtually. And yesterday, 2 of those events featured former President Barack Obama. In his pre-recorded address to students graduating from historically black colleges and universities, Mr. Obama mixed humor and traditional advice with some pointed criticism of the U.S. response to the pandemic.
More than anything, this pandemic has finally torn back the curtain on the idea that so many of the folks in charge know what they're doing. A lot of them aren't even pretending to be in charge.
The first named tropical storm of the year, Arthur, is now moving north off the coast of Florida. It's the sixth straight year for a named storm to develop before the official start of the Atlantic hurricane season on June 1st. Arthur is expected to stay mostly offshore until it brings heavy rains to parts of North Carolina's coast tonight and tomorrow. You can find all of our coronavirus coverage and news from the U.S. and around the world at pbs.org/newshour. Reverend William J. Barber has long tackled the issues of race, poverty, and hatred. Next month, his Poor People's Campaign will hold a digital assembly and march on Washington to draw attention to those and other civil rights issues. I recently spoke with Reverend Barber about the impacts of COVID-19 on communities of color for our ongoing initiative, Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. Here's a short excerpt of our longer conversation, which will appear online at Chasing the Dream. Reverend William Barber, thanks so much for joining us. When you see those statistics about how disproportionately affected people of color are in this, why do you think that the country is not as shocked as they ought be?
Well, first of all, we're not getting all the statistics. I mean, we get, like in Mississippi, 80% of the people in one area that died from COVID-19. We're not as shocked because we weren't dealing with it before. See, we weren't shocked when 250,000 people were dying from poverty and low income. You know, we weren't shocked enough when the Supreme Court rolled back the Voting Rights Act. And since 2013, we've had less voting rights than we had since 1965. And McConnell, for instance, has blocked fixing the Voting Rights Act for over 2,000 days. We weren't really shocked as a nation when we knew before COVID, 62 million people got up and worked every day without a living wage. 4 million people could get up every morning and buy unleaded gas and not buy unleaded water. We were spending 53 cents of every discretionary dollar on the military and less than 15 cents of every discretionary dollar on education, infrastructure, and healthcare. Our consciousness has and moral consciousness has been so dulled, right? And we've been locked in this Reaganism, locked in this trickle down, locked in this neoliberalism, and we've been locked in this left-right debate. The reality of poverty and low income is not about left and right. It's about the very soul and the heart of this nation, and that we are not upholding even our constitutional morality. I'm a preacher, but beyond the preaching part, establishment of justice, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare, ensuring domestic tranquility, equal protection under the law. When you look at these glaring statistics, even before COVID, we weren't shocked. So after COVID, some people still think it's over there. I'm concerned even, and I say this as an African-American, that we are not getting the data on poverty. We're not getting the data on zip code. I believe when we get the full data, we're going to see, yes, it's killing African-Americans at enormous levels, but it's also killing poor white folk in Appalachia at enormous levels. And they don't have what they need. That's why we have been pulling together this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival for 3 years, because we recognized years ago America needed a moral revival, a moral revolution of values, if you will, a conscious awakening, a shaking, you know, a restarting of the very heart of our nation, because we are in trouble when it comes to our consciousness. It is far too dull and we're accepting far too much.
How concerned are you about voter suppression, especially now, given the health concerns that people have with going to crowded places like polling stations?
I am concerned about voter suppression. I come from a voter suppression state. I know what can happen when state legislators and governors implement voter suppression law. We are so one of the things we're saying is register people to vote. We're saying to the Congress and particularly Democrats, we need that $2 billion that they need in the budget to protect our democracy. We're not going to probably get mail-in ballots. So we're saying to Democrats and other progressives, and even Republicans, if they want the black vote or the white or the poor vote, but to the progressives, you better pass some legislation, even if McConnell strikes it down, that let folk know you're willing to fight for their lives, for the poor and low, because in the fall, you're going to ask them to risk their lives to vote. Literally, people will have to risk their lives, stand in lines to vote in the midst of this pandemic. Why did people in Selma risk their lives in 1965? Because they thought what they were risking their life for was worth it. We must give people the kind of policy agenda If you vote for us, you're going to have health care that's not just connected to your job, but connected to your humanity. If you vote for us, you're going to have living wages. If you vote for us, you're going to have sick leave and adequate unemployment. If you vote for us, you're going to have access to clean water. If you vote for us, we're not going to cut your utilities off in the middle of a pandemic. We're going to have to give people a life, what I call a moral budget, a moral agenda that says we care more about life than we do about profits. And then people, I believe, will mobilize in mass numbers to vote.
Reverend William Barber, thanks so much for joining us. I hope the next conversation we have is in a time when we can do it face to face. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Love to all of you.
While layoffs and closings at large companies like Boeing, General Motors, and retailers like JCPenney often grab the headlines, small businesses make up nearly half of private sector employment. Right now, like their big business counterparts, they are struggling, and often anonymously. But as NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker reports, there is a Chicago photographer hoping to bring their plight into focus.
For Chicago photographer Candace Cusick, springtime is wedding time. For over 10 years, the former Chicago Tribune photojournalist has been in high demand, capturing wedding nuptials around the city. Practicing what she calls moment-driven photography, whether during preparations, the ceremony, or the after-party, her images are less portrait and more backstage pass. When she's not chasing brides and grooms, she's in her studio, taking pictures of people, families, or pets. Her studio is in the Chicago neighborhood known as Westtown, a neighborhood like so many in America that's now closed.
Once they issued the lockdown, we locked down, and my business essentially closed.
But after she shut her doors, Cusick says she turned to what she knows best, her camera shutter.
I've been a photographer my whole life. There's no way I could just sit on the couch during quarantine. I knew that there was a story to tell. Also, I'm actually photographing these locked down businesses because I am one of them. We need to show our faces at this point.
And this is what she's done for the last 9 weeks, taking photos of her neighbors in front of their closed storefronts. Vintage shops, bakeries, hair salons, a sprinkle of everything, she says. She reaches out via email or phone, interviewing the store owners before arranging to take their photographs. Working alone and from a distance, she says the whole shoot takes about 5 minutes, and then she posts the pictures and the stories on her Instagram account.
What's really great about this project thus far is we're all sharing just personal information. I'm asking deep questions. I'm asking what are you afraid of right now? And everybody's been really honest and candid with their answers. And the greatest thing is that we all pretty much share the same answers. We're all fearful.
What are they saying that they're afraid of?
I think the biggest concern is that people will forget us and start to shop at big box stores. They're concerned that people might not want to go shopping, period. I think the biggest scare is that Amazon is going to just take everyone's business from us.
What are the business owners telling you about the pictures after you show them?
The response has been fantastic. With this project, we are all getting to know each other a little bit better. You know, in my interviews, some business owners have just cried on the phone, and they've been candid about actually sharing this with the public. My biggest fear is a lot of these businesses won't even be in existence after lockdown. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this story so quickly is because we don't know who's going to last and we don't know who's going to survive. And we want to protect our memories. We want to share our stories. We want everyone to know that we're here.
When the Trump administration outlined federal guidelines back in March for work considered essential during the COVID-19 pandemic, it included specific language for new and existing oil pipeline construction projects. Within days, Canadian-owned TC Energy Corporation announced it had secured more than $1 billion to continue with construction of the 1,200-mile Keystone XL pipeline. The project, which was halted in 2015 by the Obama administration amid growing public outcry, was reissued permits in the early days of the Trump administration, with the stipulation that American steel be used in the work. Now, as thousands of oil workers enter states along the construction route in the midst of the pandemic, legal challenges are mounting amid health concerns. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
On March 31st, with stay-at-home orders still in place in Nebraska, South Dakota, and Montana due to the COVID-19 pandemic, oil and gas company TC Energy Corporation announced plans to proceed with construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
I found that incredible that they think that they could move ahead with this thing.
The prospect of hundreds of out-of-state oil workers flooding his state worries 68-year-old farmer Art Tandrup. He grows corn and soy in northeast Nebraska, about 900 feet from the proposed pipeline route. Tandrup is concerned that local hospitals aren't equipped to handle a potential COVID-19 outbreak pipeline workers might bring into the community.
You know, in Nebraska, we have the issues with the meatpacking plants where our numbers are skyrocketing right now. And these plants are close to the route in some cases. As a matter of fact, a couple of them are just a few miles from the route. So as these workers mingle in these communities, there's a greater chance of spreading.
66-year-old Jeannie Crumley's family has run a farm and cattle ranch in Holt County, Nebraska for 5 generations.
What was your reaction when you learned that TC Energy would be continuing with pipeline construction in the midst of this pandemic?
Oh, it's their way of doing business. We've been dealing with them for 12 years. If our children can't go to school, if our children can't swing on the swings in the park, then in the midst of all of that, then a foreign company can send whoever they want on the land we pay taxes on. How can they do all the things that we don't when we're the landowners and we're the community members?
Shortly after announcing the renewed construction plans, Keystone XL's president posted this message on TC Energy's website regarding the threat of COVID-19.
We've already made adjustments to some of our work plans in consideration of COVID-19, and will continue to collaborate with our suppliers and contractors to further enhance safety measures. Construction will only take place after giving every consideration for the health and safety of our people and their families, and for those in the surrounding communities.
The company says those adjustments include enhanced screening measures, minimizing travel in and out of work sites to essential personnel, and sanitizing transport vehicles. But Art Tandrup claims that isn't what's happening on site.
Some of our friends that have visited the pipe yards this last weekend, well, they've shown pictures. Nobody's wearing a mask. It's just business as usual, so to speak.
TC Energy did not respond to PBS NewsHour Weekend's request for an interview. The renewed construction plans sparked several legal actions by a coalition of environmentalists and indigenous rights advocates last month. They're just the latest lawsuits and ongoing legal challenges against President Trump's 2019 decision to reapprove the KXL pipeline without conducting environmental reviews that federal courts have previously ordered.
We already killed this pipeline project.
Dallas Goldtooth is a ground campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network, which filed a joint lawsuit against the Trump administration on April 5th.
President Obama declared it was not in the interest of the United States public. It went against the climate test because his administration understood that by approving this project, that it's going to greatly contribute to climate change and global greenhouse gas emissions. And what President Trump did is he went and revived it. That's why we're calling the Keystone XL pipeline the zombie pipeline. We keep stopping and shutting it down, and it keeps coming back to life.
That lawsuit awaits a decision. On April 15th, in response to a separate lawsuit, a U.S. District Court judge temporarily blocked construction of the KXL pipeline through waterways until the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers conducts studies complying with the Endangered Species Act. Jane Klebb is the founder of Bold Nebraska, a land and water protection organization that is part of that lawsuit.
So far, Judge Morris has agreed with many of the arguments that we are making, and he issued an order telling the Army Corps of Engineers they can't just do a blanket kind of permit for every water crossing, that they have to do studies on every single water crossing, which they never have done.
But construction continues in areas where the pipeline won't cross water, all in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. On April 16th, two tribal communities in Montana and South Dakota requested an injunction to stop construction in light of the pandemic, arguing the influx of thousands of transient out-of-state construction workers poses irreparable health risks to the tribes. That injunction request awaits a decision. In the meantime, Indigenous rights activists in Montana are protesting near the construction site.
We prayed today and had a little ceremony to pray against the KXL that's going to affect the people.
This month, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Montana relaxed some quarantine restrictions on non-essential businesses and lifted stay-at-home orders. Farmer Art Tandrup in Nebraska, who is also part of the Ponca Indigenous tribe there, says that's all the more reason out-of-state oil workers should not enter his community.
It's in their off time that we really have some concerns. You know, where do they eat? Where do they stay? What are they bringing with them? And right now, with the COVID going on, is not a good time to move into Nebraska, South Dakota, or Montana. Not a good time at all.
During this period of sheltering in place, some of us have been able to pick up old hobbies or maybe try something new. NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson brings us the story of a mom in Manhattan who discovered a new artistic talent while also bringing some smiles to her followers on social media.
Back in March, when Stephanie Trilling's family was newly confined to their apartment in Manhattan, her young daughter, Shira, had a lot of questions.
We live in very close proximity to four major Manhattan hospitals. And in late March, we'd hear sirens all the time, and my five-year-old daughter is in kindergarten, and she would often ask us, well, we hear sirens outside and we see ambulances. Does that mean someone inside the ambulance has coronavirus? Are they going to be okay? And these are really tough questions. So we were sitting there, and to alleviate the stress, I brought out the really high-value fun activities, the paint set.
Trilling, a lawyer by training who works in communications, picked up a brush too.
So I just started painting characters from the first book I saw, which was Elephant and Piggy Biggie by Mo Willems. And I started painting cartoons of coronaviruses into the picture.
She posted her painting online and people started asking for more. Soon, she was painting all kinds of children's book covers, reimagined for pandemic times.
I think I've gotten the largest response from Goodnight Zoom, which is a parody of Goodnight Moon, and Oh, the Places You Won't Go, which is a Dr. Seuss parody. Those have been my two biggest hits. People also really like Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad 2020.
Trilling calls the project Children's Books for Pandemics. There's Masks for Sale, The Pokey Little Vaccine, and What Do People Do All Day at Home? In Trilling's world, you don't pat the bunny. Frog and Toad are social distancing. The little engine is carrying PPE, and the magic school bus has landed deep inside someone's nose. Trilling posts a new book cover each day, and the response has been tremendous. Nearly 15 million people have seen her work on Facebook alone.
The interest grew exponentially, and it really put context to what going viral really means.
You're literally going viral.
No pun intended, but yes. I've gotten such support from people I've never met, telling me that it's really bringing them a sense of joy and giving them something to look forward to when what's coming next is so uncertain. Most of us can't leave our homes. Most of us can't see our loved ones. Most of us are having trouble buying yeast and toilet paper and cleaning products. And the fact that what I'm doing is so universal is what's resonating with people.
Trilling is working to partner with a nonprofit to figure out how to sell the prints and donate the proceeds to charity.
Do you have a background as an artist? Are you trained as an artist? Have you studied painting or drawing?
I have no art experience. I've never painted before. This was just a lark. So this has really been a wild ride for me, and I'm learning a lot as I go.
And you're doing all of this while parenting full-time and working full-time, right?
That's right. What I'm doing is at night, after everyone else goes to sleep, I sit down with my paints and my pencil and my paper, and I get to work. We may be socially distant right now, but that does not mean we need to be apart. We're all going through different things in similar circumstances, and this is bringing us together.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, the JPB Foundation, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.